This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. While historically the worst stock market performance has been in September, October has the reputation of being the spookiest month for investing. But is there a best or worst time to put your money in the stock market? Investment advisor and writer William Bernstein and financial advisor Chris DeSimio join me this afternoon for a look at the current investment numbers along with some history and an overview of the markets. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Chris, good afternoon. And William, good afternoon to you, too.
Well, good afternoon, sir.
Yeah, good afternoon, Mark, and good afternoon, Bill. Dr. Bernstein, I guess, because you are you're not a doctor, PhD doctor. You are a neurologist, are you not?
Yeah, but on this radio program, doctor isn't my first name.
Okay. Bill, a number of years ago, you wrote a book that I like so much. I bought, I think, 200 of them, and you were kind enough to autograph these books, and we distributed them to people who were seeking knowledge. And the book was called A Splendid Exchange, How Trade Shaped the World. And your latest book is called Masters of the Word, How Media Shaped History from the Alphabet to the Internet. And, of course, you also have written a number of I guess, if for lack of a better term, e-books or little mini-books. And I'm holding one in my hand here along with Masters of the Word called Deep Risk, How History Informs Portfolio Design. Which are more fun to write, the books about strictly investing or the books about the view from 30,000 or, in this case, 50,000 feet?
Well, they're completely different animals. You know, a long-form nonfiction work like A Splendid Exchange or Masters of the Word is something that consumes you for, you know, 3 or 4 years. And you're spending most of your time, you know, going to and from the library, researching things, reading, and trying to put things together. It's really not a writing process. It's really more a process for organizing your reading than anything else. Whereas, you know, writing a finance book, it's like a small piece of pizza. It takes 3 or 4 weeks or maybe a month or two at most. And you spend most of your time writing and running numbers, and it's more fun, but it's not as satisfying as writing a long-form book.
You know, it's fascinating. I have to ask you, how did you go from being a doctor to getting into investment advising?
Oh, golly, it's a shaggy dog story. You know, I live in a country that doesn't have a functioning social welfare system, so I had to go and save for my own retirement. And I approached it the way I thought any person with scientific training would do, which would be to look at the peer-reviewed literature, read basic textbooks, and then to gather data and build models. And when I did all those things, people looked at it and said, my God, you've got to publish this. This is something that small investors can use. And so I put my first book on the web in 1995 after it didn't get published, didn't get accepted for publication by any mainstream publisher, but it did well on the web, and finally that got enough attention that McGraw-Hill published me. So I did a couple of finance books, and I discovered that I enjoyed writing history, which is a very important part of finance. You can't do finance if you don't understand history, financial history. And so I decided to start writing history books, and was even more fun and even more satisfying.
Yeah, I've got the whole oven here, which I guess is your Masters of the Word. Then I have the nice piece of pizza, the book called Deep Risk. And then I have some of the ingredients. I have some of the I have the mushrooms and pepperoni in the form of small pieces of paper that I printed off that talk about market history. And, you know, Bill, here we are. It's the beginning of October. And I remember reading a long time ago in a book, and I imagine that this was a book on contrary investing. It could have been David Dreeman's book. But talked about why the fall can sometimes be a treacherous time. People are kind of hardwired. We're hardwired psychologically to think that this is a time of harvest and caution, that you know, the winter is coming and we get, you know, and for thousands of years we need to store stuff away. So there's this sense that October and the fall are bad months for the market. But unfortunately, as John Quincy Adams was fond of saying, the facts are stubborn things. And it turns out that despite all the bad rap that October gets, it's actually one of the single best months of the year for investing, depending on what time frame you go through.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, first of all, when you look at, if you just look at months of the year, you see that September has the lowest returns, as you previously mentioned. Now, whether that's statistically significant, whether it means anything, it's a very good question. There's something called data mining, which is that if you look at enough data, you'll eventually find things that arise by chance. So that's a real possibility when it comes to the September effect. Now, what's more interesting is that clearly the most spectacular crashes in the market, when they occur, they don't occur very often, but when they do occur, October seems to be when they happen. So you had the October 1929 crash, and then, of course, you had the famous one, you know, October 19th, 1987, when the broad markets went down by more than 20% in one day. And October 2008 wasn't such a good month either. And I think it's a real phenomenon. The way I look at it is from a neurobiological point of view, which is I think that the deep structures in our brains react not just to the number of hours of daylight in the day, but also how rapidly that daylight is changing. And of course, you know, on a day-to-day basis, you lose the most amount of sunlight, you know, in September and early October. So I think that's probably the reason for that. And there's some other data from other studies that show that even on given days when the weather is really bad, when there's no sunshine, the market does poorly.
Interesting.
And this holds up in any number of markets. Now, this isn't something you can make money off of.
Not from a lack of vitamin D.
Because it's too small an effect, but it is statistically significant.
Yeah. I've got some numbers here, and I found these to be fascinating. These are numbers that were easy to get my hands on, by the way. They're available at any, just about, it was easy for me to find, and I'm not that good a computer person. But when you talk about the largest one-day gains and losses, it turns out that 90% of the largest point losses occurred since the year 2000. Largest point losses, and many of them, as you mentioned, Bill, did occur in October or close by. The biggest one in terms of point losses was September 29th, close enough, as my musician friends would say, that's close enough for jazz. It's close enough to October. That was 2008. That was 5 years ago, where the market fell 777 points. And then about 2 weeks later, in October 2008, the market fell 733 points. The 1987 fiasco, a 508-point decline, that was that worked out to be 22%. That's the number one in terms of percentage gain or percentage loss. So most of these biggest point losses have happened since in the last 12 years. But if you spread it out a little bit and ask, well, how did what we just went through compare with 1929? It turns out that 80% of the largest point gains, single-day gains, occurred from 1929 through 1939, and about 45% of the largest point losses occurred in that same period.
Yeah, that's volatility. I don't tend to think in terms of point losses. I like to restrict any discussion I have to just to percentage gains, which is the last thing that you talked about. And if you look at the U.S. stock market, the history of daily moves, you'll find that those periods of time not only had the biggest point losses, but they also had the biggest, or now I'm saying it, different percentage losses, but they also had the biggest percentage gains. If you look at the period between, you know, during the crisis, for example, there were any number of days where the percentage losses were much more than 5%. But there were also days, almost equal number of days, when you had that magnitude of gains. And in fact, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but I believe there were 2 days during the crisis when there were close to 10% gains in the S&P 500.
You are absolutely correct. In fact, what a memory. The number one largest percentage gain, actually the largest 2-point gains, October of 2008, and they rank respectively number 5 and number 6. October 13th, 2008, the market up 11.8%. And in October 28th, 10.88%. These are a gain of 936 points in one day.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, the phone number to call is 513-419-7100. You can also email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And, you know, I have a question. Either one of you can field it. Out of curiosity, as an investor, what happened to the folks who did not bail out on Black Monday back in October 1987? A lot of people I know obviously did bail out, but the folks who had the fortitude to hang in there and stick with their stock investments, how have they fared since then?
Bill?
Oh, well, I don't have the precise numbers, but they've done fine. I mean, I don't have the S&P numbers in front of me, but the Dow, as I recall, fell from, I don't know, something like 2,200 to 1,700 and something, and the Dow is, I don't follow the Dow, but what is it now, Chris, something like 14,000 or something like that?
Pushing 15, but yeah, Bill, your command of numbers is spot on. It fell from 2,200 to 1,738 in one day.
Yeah, there's a joke that was told about the crash, which was this woman, you know, who had bought shares of a mutual fund 15 or 20 years before that, you know, heard about it on the radio, and she said, he calls up her mutual fund company and said, "My God, what happened? Do I have any money left?" And the lady at the other end of the line, you know, says that, "Ma'am, I'm sorry to tell you that your original investment of $10,000 has fallen to $157,000.
So the lesson here, Bill, is don't panic.
And Bill, you also in some of these books that you have, the mini books, you make a distinction between deep risk and shallow risk. And though most of us looking back 25, 26 years ago, and I remember it distinctly, in fact, CNBC was then called the Financial News Network. That's how long ago it was. That it seemed like an earth-shaking, mind-blowing day to lose 22%. We thought this will scar the financial landscape forever. This is the Grand Canyon being gouged out, right out of a Cecil B. DeMille movie. The only thing missing was Moses, Charlton Heston with his arms spread out. It was straight out of the Old Testament. And yet, not that long afterwards, people were okay. And you make a distinction then between deep risk and shallow risk. What in your work is the main difference between something that is a deep risk and a shallow risk event?
Well, what you just described was a shallow risk event. It was something that recovered itself very quickly, both in 1987 and in 2008. The markets recovered very quickly. In fact, even in 1929 to 1932, when the market lost something like 90% of its value, the recovery was relatively quick. By about 1936 or 1937, people actually got pretty much back to par. So that took 7 years. In 1987, it took a couple years. In 2008, it took about three or four years to get back to par. That's what I call shallow risk. That's if you go to sleep for 5 years or 6 years or 2 or 3 years, you'll be fine. But the markets don't always recover, all right? For example, in 1914, the St. Petersburg Stock Exchange, which was one of the world's biggest stock exchanges at the time, closed down and it never opened. Those people lost 100%. Right? Or more recently, someone who invested in Japanese stocks at the height of the market in late 1989 are still down something like 75%. In real value, in real terms, they're probably down even more. That's deep risk. All right, that's severe losses of real capital that don't recover for at least 20 or 30 years. And when you look at history, you look at financial history, particularly in the 20th century, what you find is that the biggest deep risk comes from inflation. And it's, you know, not the kind of inflation we had in the United States in the 70s or 80s, but the kind of inflation that you saw in Argentina or Brazil or Zimbabwe.
Bill, we need to come back to that. Excuse me. We've got to get to a break here. And we'll continue our market talk after the break. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU or find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. And joining me this afternoon are financial advisor Chris DeSimeo and investment advisor and writer William Bernstein. If you've got any questions, want to join our conversation, the phone call, the number to call is 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Chris, what are some of the key things and people should be looking at right now, numbers-wise?
Well, I mean, as Bill and you and I were discussing, the Dow Jones Industrial Average right now is at 15,105. It's down 86 points today. It was up a little bit yesterday. And, of course, the market not especially happy on Monday with the government shutdown, though they thought about it, had a night to think about it, and then rallied a bit yesterday. We got the number today from the ADP, the Automated Data Processing Company, which is a private payroll survey. And that number came in a little softer than had been expected. And, of course, one of the things that's interesting, Bill, you may have some comments on this too, probably the most single important data point of any given month is the employment report released by the Department of Labor, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, on the first Friday of every month. And I don't believe we're going to get that this month because of the shutdown. Is that your understanding too, Bill?
Yeah, you know, you, as the listeners probably already figured out, you pay attention to these numbers more closely than I do. I tend to take a very long-term perspective. And to be quite honest, I don't find most of these numbers all that useful for the simple reason that they're numbers that everyone knows about. And that's a famous, you know, quote from Bernard Baruch, who said that something that everyone knows isn't worth knowing. Well, you know, if you're dealing with Fed policy, if you're dealing with, you know, government economic data that's released on a certain minute of the day, it's something that, you know, you either don't know, and then the minute, you know, it does become public, everybody in the world knows about it. So, and the market adjusts to it pretty instantaneously. So
yeah,
it's just not something that I spend a lot of intellectual effort on, I guess.
Speaking of instantaneous reactions, how much is the government shutdown affecting the market? Or is the market just, is it already factored in and the market's just saying, this will pass soon enough?
Bill?
Well, you know, let's do a thought experiment. Let's imagine that, you know, there's a 10% chance the world is going to end tomorrow, all right? Well, that means that there's 100, you know, if that happens, that you'll have 100% loss. And if it doesn't end tomorrow, then everything's fine and you're back where you were. Well, what the market will do is the market will go down by 10%. All right, and if the world doesn't end, the market will go back up 10%. And if the world ends, well, it doesn't matter, you know.
The way I read, I was
a little surprised. I guess the markets didn't fall more than they did with the approaching shutdown. And I guess what the markets are saying is that this will probably get resolved, or if it doesn't get resolved, it won't do that much economic damage, or it certainly won't do that much damage to corporate profits.
Yeah.
And the market could be right, and the market could be wrong. But I don't think, you know, the key thing is, can you make any money by trying to outguess the market? And I think, as both, you know, Chris would agree with me when I say this, that, you know, you're not smarter than the market is. You know, you're not capable of making judgments that are better than the market's, because you don't know anything the market doesn't already know.
Yeah. And where does that lead one then, Bill, in the world of how to allocate assets then? In a number of your writings, especially in your series Books for Adults, Investing for Adults, you talk about the permanent portfolio, the two Harrys that you talk about, Harry Markowitz and Harry Brown. And you talk about what they're protecting against. Asset allocation has been, you know, it's been a hot topic for a long time, I guess ever since the Brinson and Bebauer and Hood paper back in the about 30 years ago or so. And yet it hasn't been available to people, and a way to do it gracefully and inexpensively for until just the not too distant past. How should someone go about determining what is a proper asset allocation, and then how to execute it?
Well, the very first thing you have to do is you have to educate yourself. You know, you should, you know, no sooner try to invest your own money without doing some very basic reading about finance than a doctor would be trying to do medicine without learning, you know, physiology or anatomy or pharmacology. You're flying blind if you're just, you know, putting, you know, setting up an allocation and investing in a given list of mutual funds. But once you've done that and you understand about the history of markets and you understand, you know, a small amount of the math, you have to ask yourself, what's my time horizon? And, you know, if your time horizon is very long, then you can invest in riskier assets. If your time horizon is short, if you're saving for next year's tuition or for a home down payment in 2 or 3 years, you'd better keep that money in very safe instruments like, you know, T-bills and CDs, no matter how low they're yielding, because you don't want to take the risk that's beyond that. Now, the other question you always have to ask yourself is, how tolerant am I of risk? And the only, you know, you can fill out, you know, all of the questionnaires you want, but at the end of the day, you're not going to find that out without getting, you know, your boots dirty, and investing money in risky assets and seeing how you respond when the market falls by 20 or 50%. You know, do you sell in panic? Well, then you shouldn't own a lot of risky assets if that's what happens to you. If you can hold on, you probably got average risk tolerance. And if you dig in and you buy more when prices fall a lot, then you're probably highly risk tolerant. And so it's a question of your, you know, capacity to take risk and whether you should take risk or not.
Great point.
We've got some questions by email. Marion writes us and she asks, my husband and I are nearing retirement completely in stocks. However, as much as I want to diversify, everything I read seems to indicate bonds are not the place to be. So her question is, given the current market conditions, what type of bond should I be investing in?
Bill?
Well, you know, first of all, I think I can generally say that someone who is approaching retirement shouldn't have an abnormally high stock allocation. Certainly, it shouldn't be much more than 50%. You know, maybe 60% might be the maximum you'd tolerate. Someone who is approaching retirement probably ought to be 50% or even somewhat below that. And you're quite right. Bonds are very risky right now because rates are very low. And if rates rise, then bond prices will fall. The way you counteract that is the way you immunize yourself against that is by keeping your bond durations short. So you can buy, for example, you know, treasury bills or treasury notes that have very short maturities. You can buy CDs that have short maturities as well. The cost of doing that, of course, is that the yields are very low. But I think that, you know, there comes a point when you need riskless assets, you need safe assets to retire on, and there comes a point where you just have to hold your nose and say, I don't care how low the yields are, I'm not going to take the kind of risk that you take when you buy a longer bond that has, you know, longer treasury that might have a yield of 2.5 or 3%, or to buy a high yield corporate bond that has a much higher yield, but also has a real risk of losing all your money.
Bill, what are your thoughts on some of the alternative bond investments, such as the so-called bank loans, floating rate funds, or convertibles to fill in that gap?
Yeah, again, that's not something that I pay a lot of attention to because I don't believe there are any free lunches. You know, where if you're going to get a higher expected return, it's got to come at the cost of higher risk. And I think especially a lot of these special purpose vehicles have a lot of risks that are not only overt, but they're hidden as well.
How about commodities? You know, there are constant TV and radio ads for gold, for example, as a good investment. What should folks look for in that respect? Should they look at it in forms such as coins, bars, futures, or just not even consider gold at this point at all?
Well, you know, one of the basic tenets of investing, one of the basic truisms of investing is that when everybody owns something, you shouldn't be owning it, okay? So there's been a lot of interest in gold the past several years, and you can spin a lot of really good stories as to why the value of gold should be high. You know, the Fed's printing money, people are losing confidence in governments, and, you know, a lot of what I call blah, blah. I don't pay much attention to that. That's why the price of gold has gone up. But when you can when you can, one of the things you learn from financial history is when all your friends own something, when there are all these convincing stories out there about why you should own something, then you probably shouldn't own it. And the real reason is simple. In order for the price of that gold to go up, more people have to buy it. Well, if everybody owns it, more people can't buy it. All right. And you see that in the history of gold, and precious metals. 12 years ago, you couldn't give gold away. You couldn't give gold, precious metals mining stocks away, gold mining stocks away. And consequently, they were very cheap. And the stories that you read back then were, oh, golly, the central banks are all selling their gold reserves, and this doesn't belong as in the allocation of any investor. Well, that was precisely the right time to buy them. Okay. When somebody's telling you that you've got to own commodities, you've got to own gold, I would be very wary.
Yeah, and in some of your writings, Bill, you point out that much to the 180-degree opposite of what people believe, that gold itself has not really proven itself, according to your research, to be a good hedge against inflation. In fact, you hold the belief that it's a better protection against the opposite of inflation, namely deflation. How does that work?
Well, it turns out when you look at it, that there's a very loose positive correlation. So gold tends to do a little better with inflation, but it doesn't always happen. And the classic example of that was if you were a Brazilian, for example, between 1980 and 2000, their currency inflated horribly. They had horrible inflation, but if you were a Brazilian and you bought gold in 1980, 20 years later, you suffered a real loss of about 70%. All right, because the price of gold fell, even though there was bad inflation in Brazil. It turns out that gold does best not with inflation so much as when there's loss of confidence. And that very often is associated with deflation. All right. So it turns out that the highest gold returns, when you go back and you look at the past 100 years, have occurred during years when there was net deflation. All right, when the economy was really doing terribly and people were losing confidence in the institutions underlying society itself. So that's where gold is useful. I'm not a big believer in gold. I have no problem with owning a few percent of gold bars or gold precious metals mining stocks in a portfolio, but I don't think it should be a big holding.
513-419-7100. If you have any questions for William Bernstein, you can also email questions@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And we have a question that came in from Bill. What's the suggestion for how much one should have in say, their 401k or their IRA to feel secure for retirement? Is there a set figure that advisors use when they're working with customers?
A dollar amount?
A dollar amount, percentage amount of your income maybe?
Bill, jump in here, but I think all of us kind of look at it differently. You first figure out how much money you need to consume and then figure out what a reasonable, distribution rate, not to be confused with rate of return. You figure out what a reasonable distribution rate is and then work backward to figure out how big the nest egg has to be to sustain that kind of spending. And, of course, in an overall plan, you factor in all the resources, not just the portfolio, but any pension assets, any annuity assets that might be coming to them on a monthly basis, Social Security and the like. Is that how pretty much you go about it as well, Bill?
Yeah, it's actually a very simple problem if you think about it. Let's just take a concrete example of someone who needs $70,000 a year to retire on, and let's assume they're getting 30 from Social Security. Okay, well, that means that they've got a shortfall to make up in retirement of $40,000. Now, the rule that's the most common rule out there is the 4% rule, and what that really says is you need to save up 25 years of your living expenses. All right. Because, 1/25 is 4%. And so you multiply, $40,000 times 25 and you get $1 million. So basically what you do is you take, the money that you need beyond your pension and beyond Social Security, and you multiply that by 25. And that's about what you should have. Now, if you're really lucky, you've got a military pension, you've got a pension from another second job, you've got Social Security, and then, if that all covers your living expenses, you really only need enough money for emergencies and for dinners out. but most people aren't in that situation.
Yeah, that's becoming increasingly rare. What about, though, and Bill, you go into this in a lot of your writings, you've been somewhat an outspoken critic of the long-term use of bonds throughout history. And of course, for history for you goes back thousands of years. I'm not sure what kind of bond market existed in the early days, but some of the earliest writing, the cuneiform, cuneiform was invented not so much to do artistic expression, but it was to actually, you know, write down legal documents, legal contracts, almost futures contracts. Bonds as an instrument, as an asset class for longer term investing, what's the risk with those?
Well, you have to differentiate bonds from more normal fixed income assets. The classic, you know, tripartite distribution is between cash, bonds, and bills. Between stocks, bonds, and bills. And so when you say bonds and bills, what's the difference? Well, a bond has a long maturity, of, say, at least 15, 20, 25, 30 years. Whereas a bill is something that, you know, has a maturity by definition of less than 1 year. And that's sort of a definitional thing. I think a more useful way to look at it is just to say there's cash that is something that's got a relatively short maturity and something that has a longer maturity, which I would call a bond. And I'm not a big fan of long bonds with long maturities, because you can really, if there's inflation, bonds are going to do terribly. They're going to lose very large percentages of their value. And in fact, in the United States, between 1940 and 1980, the long bond lost something like 70% or almost 70% of its real value, of its inflation-adjusted value. Stocks, on the other hand, do very well with inflation, which is one of the reasons why you want to own at least some stocks. So, you know, if you decided, for example, you want to own 50% stocks, what do you put the other 50% into? And I'm a big believer in using relatively short-term fixed income instruments. So T-bills of less than a year, notes of maybe treasury notes that are maybe of less right now than 2 or 3 years, CDs of a couple years maturity. That's the sort of thing you want to invest in, because if rates go up dramatically, then at least you get to roll them over at the higher rate.
Good idea.
Whereas
with
the bond, you're just taking a big-time capital loss.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. After the break, more with William Bernstein. In about 13 minutes, why carbon capture and sequestration is about to become a more familiar term. You can join our conversation by calling 513-419-7100. You can email your questions to talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining me this afternoon are investment advisor and writer William Bernstein and financial advisor Chris DeSimio. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Now, we were talking earlier about how the government shutdown may be having an effect on the market. We've got another crisis that's brewing off in the distance, and that's the debt ceiling debate. What impact do you see that having?
Well, it's been said that could be potentially a bigger problem, because that might affect the full faith and credit issue of the government. If you own these bonds and bills, you're accustomed to timely payment of principal and interest, and 2 years ago, if you recall, when people were playing with the idea of defaulting, the market declined. It triggered what was then a bear market, a decline of nearly 20% 2 years ago in 2011. That ironically ended in October, but from May through September, it was a horrible, horrible time. And to kind of exhume that, to dig that up, is not something people are wanting to see and wanting to deal with. And yet again, to get back to Bill's point, sometimes in the short run, it's a shallow risk thing. Bill, do you think if the government of the United States were to default on debt, would that be a shallow or deep risk?
That's the one thing that we're talking about could very well be a deep risk. And I think it's sort of in the same ballpark of the thought experiment I talked about earlier, which is, you know, it's I wouldn't say it's an end of the world event, but it's an event that could seriously damage the economy and very seriously damage the stock prices, the prices of stocks. Now, the question is how likely is it really? And I think that it's very unlikely on the, you know, the range of perhaps a few percent. So what that tells you is that the market, knowing this, is probably 2% lower than it otherwise would be. And if we avoid it, the market will probably go up by, you know, that amount. I mean, I'm picking numbers out of the air, but you see what I'm saying is I think the market has already impounded that into prices. Now, I think there's an intermediate scenario, which I think is perhaps more likely. If you remember, during the financial crisis, the House voted down the first TARP. And I can remember, I hate to admit this, but I actually did watch CNBC during this. And you saw that as the votes were piling up, the Dow was dropping and dropping. Vote by vote, yeah, exactly. And the Dow went down, I don't know, something like 400 points or something like that day. And the Congress members said, holy cow, you know, if we really don't pass this thing, if we completely let it slide by the wayside, if we don't pass it within a week or two, the economy's in very deep trouble. And I think we very well may see something like that happen, which is that as we get to October 14th, 15th, 16th, we may see some declines in the markets, and that will get Congress's attention. Congress people don't like it when the market goes down 500 points because of something they did or didn't do.
Good,
I think that would probably force a solution.
Yeah, you know, Bill, and you bring up a really good point that, you know, the market has this echo chamber kind of feel to it where people are watching their favorite electronic media, whether it's CNBC or Bloomberg or you name it, and that feeds on itself. Years ago, 30 years ago, 35 years ago, the spread of financial information really wasn't all that great. Quote machines were in the hands of a very few people. You had to call up a financial advisor, a stockbroker, and find out what the market was doing. The internet changed all that. It democratized data. In your book, Masters of the Word, you cover everything from the invention of writing in cuneiform and pre-cuneiform with the little almost the monopoly trinkets that were used in ancient in the Mesopotamia. You cover everything, and then you towards the end of the book you get into the birth of the internet and how it has changed everything. You call that chapter the Argus. How can people make money understanding the role that media plays in the financial world? What are some of the ways that, as an investor, if you wanted to play the media, or not so much play the media, but take a position in media, how would you do? How would you go about that?
Well, I would ignore it. It is this echo chamber, and it frequently moves markets in ways that, in the long run, and even in the short term, don't make sense. And, you know, what I like, I'm a real fan of CNBC. The way I describe it is I like to say that if you watch it too much, it will make you poor and stupid. and you can tell how much of a fan I am of CNBC. And I think that's really true. I think, you know, the smartest thing you can do is to ignore the news. And in fact, you know, there are good academic studies, Chris, as you well know, that demonstrate that the less frequently that people check their stock investments, the less frequently they pay attention to financial news, the better they do.
Andreessen, there's a gentleman named Andreessen who did a lot of work in that field about 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah. I remember I was at a conference a couple of years ago, and somebody asked a question about the flash crash. And there was a guy in the back of the room who I happen to know personally and is a very successful investor, probably more successful than most of the people in the room. And he raised his hand with a quizzical look on the face and said, "What was the flash crash?" Okay. And you know, for those of you who don't remember it, it happened, I think, in May of 2011. It was a computer glitch, and the market went down, you know, some very large number of points in a few minutes.
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't not notice it unless you were really intentionally not paying attention, and that's what this guy had taught himself to do.
Yeah, and I believe just to go back in time, if I had to bet on it, and I don't bet on a lot of things, but I distinctly remember that was, I think, in May of 2010, because it was we'd had a big rally, and 2011 was the precursor to the budget.
The European crisis. You're right. It was 2010.
Yeah. But it was it was tricky because, as you mentioned, there were trading glitches, and we still have these. You know, in your book, Splendid Exchange, you talk about Somali pirates, and I thought you talk about piracy. And I thought, oh well, that doesn't happen anymore. And of course, within a month or two of reading your book, A Splendid Exchange, suddenly the Somali pirates are in the news. Talk about computer glitches. We thought we'd work those all out, but it seems like there have been three or four where certain stocks just don't get traded, and NASDAQ is still having problems.
And I think that will get worse. Until we finally decide that we want to do something about high frequency trading. You know, what we've got is basically a 3-mile island of an electronic financial market. It's a tightly linked complex system, and tightly linked complex systems have accidents. It's something that systems theorists call normal accidents. All right, which is just falls out of the system being so complex and having so many poorly perceived positive feedback loops.
Is that one of the reasons that it seems like the market, it always seems like there's some crisis that it's reacting to? Is that one of the reasons why nowadays it seems to just, it turns on a dime from one day to the next? You can't figure out, you can't keep up with which direction the market's going to go in.
Yeah. I mean, that's the nature of markets. I mean, they are completely unpredictable. They are random. All the things that you know about have already been impounded into the price, and the only thing that moves markets are A, surprises, or B, changes in the animal spirits. People just decide that they're more optimistic, and that optimism feeds on itself. That's something we really haven't talked about. Bob Shiller at Yale talks a lot about it, and I think he's right on the mark, which is that a lot of things that happen in the market are self-referential. They happen because people just move in herds.
It's fascinating stuff. Shiller, of course, has the Case-Shiller price index that they sold to Standard & Poor's. And one of the people who, at least he was one of the lone voices in the wilderness back in 2005, 2006, suggesting that real estate prices might not continue to rally. And that was, if you were paying attention, that was one of the very first signs that was broadcast publicly that there was trouble afoot.
Yeah, no. Shiller's. I don't listen to very many market pundits, but Shiller is certainly one of the people who bears some attention.
So, advice for the average investor, I guess, keep in mind that asset allocation is an important thing, and also that time is your biggest ally. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true. I mean, you know, it's a truism that compound interest is a magical force. I mean, if you can actually get 7 or 8% return over a 40-year period, you're going to wind up with a lot of money.
That's a great way to end the day.
So don't lose your cool. Don't panic. Just keep your eye on the goal.
And get a good, broad, long view of history through some great books, such as some of Bill Bernstein's Masters of the Word or Splendid Exchange.
Thank you. Thank you both for joining me this afternoon. Investment advisor and writer William Bernstein, and also financial advisor Krista Simeo.
Always good to be here.